Eduardo Gutierrez, we're in Lubbock. It's November the 3rd, and you're agreeing to do this voluntarily, and you will execute a deed of gift form at the right time and so on. Okay. Ed, you need to tell us a little bit about yourself. You also need to tell us about your career. You need to tell us about your view. So why don't we start backwards here, since you were in the room and listening to the other interview. Who do you think is our most effective organizations for Mexican-Americans in the country today?
Well, in terms of national organizations, I think the National Council of Vasa certainly carries a lot of leverage, especially as it relates to Hispanic marketing and issues that relate to corporate interests, and also issues that relate to policy issues relating to Latinos in general. I think NCLR is probably the most the largest organization in terms of dealing with those kind of issues. I think as it relates to statewide or state issues, I think GI Forum in many ways can leverage things for Latinos and Chicanos in Texas and so forth. I think LULAC as a whole also, and depending on the councils, can affect change, especially in the areas of education and discrimination. But I think overall the largest one that I can think of is National Council of ASA, of which I'm an affiliate at this point, and also the vice president of the Texas affiliates.
Well, tell me a little bit about that structure.
The structure.
Who can be an affiliate, and what is this Texas business you're talking about?
The affiliates are basically the affiliate structure. In order to be an affiliate of the National Council of ASA, you have to have comprised of a board of directors that comprise more than, I believe, half, don't quote me on this, but I think half or more of Hispanic, Latino, Chicano representation, deal in areas that affect change for Latinos, etc. The affiliate structure was just started, the Texas affiliate structure was just started recently, as far as I know, to handle the concerns and the issues dealing with Texas for those affiliates that are national affiliates also. They have an office in San Antonio, which Francis Terán runs, with some staff people dealing in housing and health-related issues and just issues in general. So I was nominated and elected by the Texas affiliates to be the vice chair. Reto Luera is now the president and the chair of the affiliates.
So your company is a nonprofit?
Our corporation is a 501c3 nonprofit.
What's the name?
Student Alternatives Program Incorporated, Inc.
Yeah. Student Alternatives. Is there some acronym there?
No, not really. Okay. It wasn't set up to have a sexy acronym or anything. Sometimes maybe I should have thought of that when I started, because it does SAP spell SAP, you know, so I don't know whether we want to get the sap out of the tree or just the people that are involved with us are saps. But no, it wasn't started for acronym purposes at all.
All right. Well, in a nutshell, but we'll get to it. Just what does that do? So we'll get back to organization.
What we do is basically our main cup of tea, our main ingredient, so to speak, is taking a look at at-risk kids in different areas of the state. We have a lot of mostly in Chicano areas in Texas. And then we identify school districts that would like to have outside sources provide curriculum instruction to those kids that they're having problems with in the mainstream school. So basically what that translates to is contracts with local school boards and school districts to provide curriculum, a turnkey operation and curriculum instruction and some counseling for those kids that are identified as at risk, either both dropout recovery, which we recover, or kids that are at risk of dropping out that they refer to us that are already in their system.
When did you start this?
We started, we formalized the, got the nonprofit in 1989, December of 89, but for all practical purposes, we started our first year of instruction in 92.
Okay.
So we've been at it a little over 5 years.
Who do you think our most effective Mexican American leaders are?
In terms of Texas or national or both?
Take your pick. or local? Where
okay,
you live in San Antonio.
I live in San Antonio. Depends on I think a very effective leader in San Antonio is Roger Flores, who's a city councilman. Might get some arguments on that, but in terms of staying on top of his issues in his district, I think he's very key.
Isn't he running for Congress now?
No, sir.
He's not one of them.
No, he's not one. He was looking at that, but I don't think he's looking at that right now. I think in terms of statewide, I think if you look in the valley, I think the mayor of Mission, who is considering throwing his hat in the ring, is also a very good leader. You're going to get arguments on that also.
Who is it?
Richard Ramirez, I believe is his name. He's been the mayor. I think he works for Texas Legal Services. Pretty good administrator, good leader in terms of city kind of things.
So you're throwing his head in the ring for what?
For the county judgeship there in Hidalgo
okay.
County.
Okay.
I think the new mayor in El Paso has got a lot of potential. Can't think of his name right now, but I hear very good things about him. Nationally, that's getting harder to identify these days. I haven't really kept up too much with the national leadership, but I think Raulisa Aguirre, from speaking on behalf of the National Council of Raza, has been very vocal and has gotten a lot of exposure over the last 6 or 7 years, just by the mere fact that that he's the director of. President of the National Council of Raza, I would consider him a leadership position. I would consider Jose Angel Gutierrez in a leadership position in many ways, as it relates to what he's doing at the university level and in the civil rights area and so forth. I still don't think he's totally out of the picture in terms of his political clout in many ways. So those are the people that I think.
Well, thank you for that.
leadership situation. I think that's basically it. I think.
In terms of issues, what do you think are the most important issues at the moment for the Mexican American community?
I think education is right there at the top. There's still a lot, not only just at the secondary level, but it goes below that into the primary grades. I still don't think there's enough. Especially in areas like Lubbock, and not just Lubbock, but even in San Antonio and El Paso, where there's a larger Chicano population. I think a lot of the younger kids are getting mismatched, so to speak, and I think they're not paying enough attention to those needs at that early development level. And again, for sure, at the secondary level, we see kids that fall through the cracks all the time. And these are kids that are not necessarily your low achievers or low learners or whatever you want to label these kids. These are just kids that are either bored or are totally out of the picture in the mainstream setting. I think the gang situation is over exaggerated. I think there's a gang problem. I think there are problems, drug problems. There are substance abuse problem and so forth with our youth at this point because of the availability, but I think a lot of our kids are getting a bum rap just by their mere looks and their mere image that they have at this point. I think they're getting a bum rap. I like to look at it as the old Jimmy Dean motorcycle gang kind of thing. If anybody rode in a motorcycle, all of a sudden they were considered the bad element, and I think a lot of our kids are getting thrown in to that stereotype.
Well, that's a good metaphor. When Honda came on the scene, then being on a motorcycle was great.
Right.
Cleaned up the image.
Right.
Why has the educational lobby and business not been able to solve these problems for Mexican Americans in education?
Because I think they've looked at it in your typical frame of reference. I think your task forces, your blue ribbon panels and everything that look at education, look at education from a traditional standpoint. They look at an education from what's wrong with our school, what's wrong with our district, without really looking at the inner workings of the system itself and trying to reform the inner workings and not the exit workings of the thing. In other words, for example, the TAS. The TAS situation is a situation that looks at the kid after he's gone through the system. They're not looking at the system in itself to see why that kid is not doing well or is doing poorly within the established structure that they have. For example, no one at this point is willing to look at the time-driven kind of things. The reason we even got into this business is because of the open entry, open exit, self-paced, competency-based curriculum that we were interested in. Everything's geared around 6 weeks grade, semester grades, or weeks and months and semesters and Christmas vacation and so forth. And nobody's really willing to take a look at the traditional approach and reforming the approach versus reforming the results. It's a lot easier to take a look at the results and then they say, we need to do this, this, and this, instead of saying, why did they get to this point in the first place? I don't think that's being taken a look at all in most cases. And another thing is the proliferation of providing incentives to those people that are going to succeed anyway, to the A students and the B students and the Lorenzo Zavala kind of thing, where you take the best kids in the Chicano communities throughout the state and you give them an idea of how the system in Austin works and so forth.
You're talking about the institute that
Mr. Nieto and those folks. I think it's a great deal, but it's geared around those kids that are going to succeed and find out what the system's all about anyway, if they get a push from their parents or anything else. And then there's that whole cadre of kids that we deal with that where they are no magazines either in Spanish or in English at home. There's no books at home. There's no proliferation of incentives that would drive them to be better readers or to read more, to be more on top of current events and so forth. And there's not enough done, in my opinion, for those kids, except maybe special curriculums and in programs such as ourselves.
Some people say that the fundamental problem is that the school system is wrong in its strategy because they're just simply trying to make Anglos out of all children.
That
is a national purpose.
You're right. They're looking at it from a very homogeneous kind of a perspective. And here again, it's one of these concepts that a teacher goes in and they have the lesson plan for the kids. And those kids may not necessarily be at the same level or have the same interest that lesson plan presents. There needs to be, in my opinion, a little bit more. You need to develop something that would fit the individual student plan versus an overall class plan. And I think if people did that a little bit more and take a look at every one of those students that are in those classrooms and develop a plan for them, customize a plan for them, that you have better results in the long term.
How is your program different? What are you all doing that's successful?
Well, I think that's one of the things we're doing. We're individual. When a kid comes to us, we take a look what he's strong at, what he's weak at. We take him at his competency level and then just take him from there and work. If he has to work slower, we don't try to speed him up. We try to keep him on task. But in terms of a kid that needs more time to, nothing says that a kid can't get a Algebra 1 credit in 15 weeks versus 6 weeks or 8 weeks. So we don't do our approach to this kid on a time-driven kind of thing. You got to do it in 6 weeks. You got to do it in 8 weeks. We do tell them, hey, get on it. Get on it. Stay on task. But we try to work with the kid to do his work as long as it takes him to do it. And then there's some kids that are accelerated to the point that if they want to go faster, then we take them faster instead of keeping them on that time-driven kind of a schedule.
Can I assume that these are all Mexican-American kids that you serve?
I would say 80% of the kids that we serve are Chicano kids, yes.
So do you instruct in Spanish as well? Or
in some kids, for those kids that do have problems in speaking English, we do a lot of instruction in Spanish, right? We speak a lot of Spanish in our classrooms too.
Well, what are your views on bilingual ed? There's a movement afoot now to eliminate it completely after years and years of being a staple of part of the educational curriculum.
I think we don't have any bilingual philosophy in our schools. You know, whatever it takes. If it takes speaking English, we speak in English. If it takes speaking in Spanish, and if it takes instruction in Spanish, then we do it. We don't follow any particular bilingual, you know, sanctioned curriculum or anything. We look at it as whatever it takes. If a kid needs instruction in Spanish, we give it to him in Spanish. And if they have problems with Spanish, we go with English. We're geared basically to get these kids academically on track. And in some cases where the kids have difficult problems, where they have some other problems either at home or within themselves or within the community, we try to work with the existing resources to try to get those problems solved.
Do you have a cultural component to this?
In some cases, yeah, we have culture. We've done the biggest thing we've done so far has been with our particular kids has been in the area of the arts. We've got a very, very small grant, two small grants from the Texas Commission on the Arts, where we had some Chicano artists work with our kids in terms of doing cultural, artistic endeavors.
So we're talking paintings, or music, or sculpture, or poetry?
Some murals in our schools, paintings in our schools, and et cetera. We try to get as much literature as possible. I know prior to Tony Urciaga dying and Ricardo dying, we provide a lot of literature, outside literature that they can read, both in the arts and now that we bought quite a few copies of Mario. He just published the Chicano athletes, Mexican American football players. Mario, we both know him, Jose Angel from San Antonio.
Longoria.
Mario Longoria, yeah. We bought several, you know, quite a few books. But mostly, you know, in terms of an organized kind of thing, it's been in the art area. And to a certain extent, it's sort of selfish, too, because they get credit for the art. You know, they get class credits and art credits, elective credits for that, too. So we still have a way to go in that. In McAllen, we're getting into a larger facility. We're buying a larger facility, and we're gonna with some folks there possibly get in the Valle Folklorico area and those areas.
So you own your building?
Some of our buildings.
We own
four facilities at this point, and looking at others.
Where are they located?
One is located in Mercedes. One in San Antonio, which is mostly a corporate. You know, it's used for payroll and inventory and that kind of thing, and accounts receivable and payable. And in McAllen and Los Fresnos, and in Brownfield, we own five buildings.
Oh, so one out here in
Brownfield, Texas. Where I graduated from high school. Yeah.
Oh, you're going back to your hometown.
Yeah, I'm going back to my own hometown.
Okay. Well, we'll get to that. So, how many programs do you have?
Right now, we have 30 contracts with school districts, and we have 15 sites.
So 0 to 30 in like 4 years. That's remarkable.
Yeah. In 4.5 years.
What's the biggest problem in getting a contract?
Board politics, change of administration has been a problem for us. The control factor, we want to control our own school.
But these kids are like rejects. They don't want them there anymore.
In most cases, they're pushouts, yeah.
They're still territorial?
There's still some territorial. Well, the dropouts are not quite as territorial. Where we have problems with school districts is where for kids that they already have, they may not be attending, but they're still on the books. So they give them to us. They might have 50% attendance when they were going to the main school. They give them to us. Now it's 80% attendance. And they say, uh-huh.
We want that 30% back.
That's right. We want the 30% back. And we'd rather have the control of our administrators and our school board controlling those factors versus some guy from San Antonio coming in and telling his local staff what to do, that kind of thing.
Well, What is the per head cost? How much money do you get from the school?
It depends on the contract. Our average is about $20 a day per student.
This is not fixed by the state? Every district is different?
Every district, we negotiate a...
I'm going to get some water. You want some water?
Sure.
Go ahead.
Every district, there's nothing that binds the districts in terms of how much they can pay for these services. Generally, from the standpoint of the way we market this thing, is that we look at the district and we look at we get an idea of what their average daily attendance, what they get, you know, from the state. Obviously, the poorer the district, the higher the ADA. So I would imagine like Crystal City probably gets a little higher ADA than Los Fresnos, which is located in the South Padre area, where they don't even get ADA. Their tax base is large enough where they don't even get ADA. So it's hard to market with the Port Isabel folks in terms of ADA when they don't have it. So that's basically our marketing strategy when we go to the district. We pretty much know what their ADA is, and we negotiate around that figure. We do have we have two contracts with two counties, one in Hidalgo County and one here in Terry County, which is Brownfield, to deal with their adjudicated youth, kids that have been, that are on the last leg, so to speak, in the legal process.
So is this a new venture?
This is a new venture based on Senate Bill 1, Chapter 37. There's actually three tiers of kids that we serve. The one that I've been explaining about, the at-risk and dropout, that's what we call Tier 1. These are kids that are basically okay with the law and haven't done, you know, anything too much out of the ordinary in terms of getting into the legal problem. Then under Senate Bill 1, there's the safe schools component, which means that any teacher, by under the law at this point, that does not want a student in their classroom for behavioral problems, it could be anything from giving someone a lewd signal or whatever, to talking back to the teacher. You know, it depends on the local code of conduct. Then those kids are put into a disciplinary alternative education program. We have some of those, Tier 2. Then the Tier 3 under this new Senate bill that came out of this last legislature now says that in lieu of expulsion, there's two types of expulsions. Now, there's discretionary expulsion for those kids that commit a crime, actual crime. You know, talking back to a teacher might not be a crime as such, but let's say a drug-related crime, a firearms-related crime, depending on the drugs, of course. It's a felony offense on campus or 200 yards from campus. Then it's a mandatory expulsion. The school board has no choice. The police write a report, they report it to the juvenile probation people, and then they place them in our Tier 3 program, in our JJAP program. And the discretionary expulsion kids are those kids that might have a joint or two of grass or, you know, a misdemeanor amount of other substances or whatever, drinking beer in the parking lot or whatever. That might constitute a crime, but it's on a misdemeanor basis, then they go to a discretionary center. In other words, they don't want any kids on the street. If it's for the big stuff, it's mandatory. School district doesn't have anything to do, it's a county problem. If it's a discretionary kid, if it's a misdemeanor kid, then the kid has to go through the hearing and then the expulsion and then placement into discretionary placement.
Well, what other new ventures are you going to get into?
Where are you looking? We're looking at the charter school situation.
How many Chicano charter schools are there?
Oh, gosh, I don't know. I know of two of them that I know of, and that's the Raul Isaguirre Charter School in Houston that's run by Tejanos in Action, and I think Dr. Garza in Corpus Christi has a school also.
Margaret, or what's her name? Maria Luisa?
Maria Luisa Garza. Dr. Maria Luisa Garza has a charter school in Houston. I think that's for elementary stage.
In Corpus.
In Corpus, rather. And the one in Houston was for middle school kids, if I'm not mistaken. We're proposing four charter schools. We're going to be applying for four charter schools. One here in Lubbock, one in El Paso, one in Laredo, and one in Mercedes.
Now, when you say four, are you talking about coordinating and being uniform in the curriculum and the approach? Because they all got to be standalone.
They got to be standalone. The four will be basically whatever the management board and the operating board at the local level, which we'll set up, feels is that is necessary at that level, at the local level.
Are you getting your feet wet with starting one, or are you going to do all four at one time?
No, we're going to do four at one time if we have to. We feel that we have the administrative infrastructure in place and the fiscal infrastructure in place that we can we would have no problem starting four.
How much do you get per head under that concept?
Under that concept, at a minimum, we would get approximately $3,300 per student for 180 days of curriculum. So it's for a 10-month or a regular school year, we're looking at roughly $1,833 a day. That's on a minimum. Of course, we could qualify for state cop money. We could qualify for facilities money. We qualify for any additional monies that are available to any other school district in the state. Technology money for computers, curriculum money, any federal money that might be open to schools, we have a shot at getting. So if that's bare bones. The $3,300 would be bare bones.
And are you starting at the elementary or middle school?
We're
or high school
going to
or?
Start at the high school because we feel that's where we have the best experience base. If we're going to replicate what we're doing and enhance what we're doing, I think it'd probably be the best shot to start from the high school and work our way down. We in our 5-year plan, we intend to after maybe the second year start looking at middle school and then take it from there and just go down as we need to go down.
What made you get into this?
Ooh, what made me get into this was that I was in San Antonio, Texas. I had resigned from the Levi Strauss Foundation, and the Levi Strauss Foundation was dabbling in education somewhat. And then I resigned from them, and I went to work with a Kellogg grant. It's called Partnership for Hope. So it was an organization that...
As a technician or as a recipient?
No, as a technician, as a staff person. And that was 1987-88. It was just an issue of looking, of reading the newspaper. In other words, the dropout percentages in San Antonio, the schools that were being cited for having too many dropouts, etc. So that's a niche that I started getting into with this Kellogg Foundation, and it paid my beans and my rent and stuff. So that was a niche I got started getting into, and I formalized a focus group there in San Antonio to take a look at out-of-school youth. And I involved as many, district people as possible and so forth. And then through that focus group, I met Dr. Garcia from TEA that basically said, you ought to look into this new Senate Bill 1668, which Judith Saperini was sponsoring. I didn't know Ms. Saperini at that time personally, but I knew a lot of people that knew Judy Saperini. And I set up a meeting with her. And then she explained what the concept was, and the concept was very simple. And it was a concept whereby school districts could contract with community-based organizations to provide curriculum and instruction at the high school level, and school districts would be allowed to contract with these community-based organizations, nonprofits. That's what flashed at that point. At that point, then I said, well, what do I have to do? Well, I have to set up a nonprofit corporation, a 501c3 to begin with, to even start looking at this thing. By that time, I had left the Rockefeller Foundation. I'd got the Middle Rio Grande Development Council interested in the concept. Benito Perez from Crystal City, Alejandro Perez from Crystal City, Leodoro, in Cotula, and some of the leadership at the Middle Rio Grande Development Council area, which is several counties there in Southwest Texas, and they the council gave me a consultant contract to start setting up something, a regional alternative school in that area. I'd already had my nonprofit, but I didn't want to go the nonprofit route. I felt that at that point I was contracting out with the Middle Rio Grande. And then these other school districts started talking to me, well, do the same thing for us. And then I set up the model for the alternative school. You know, I worked on the model for the alternative school. That paid my beans through that period. And then I set up the alternative model in the Eagle Pass school and helped them with a grant.
Was that the first one?
That was the first one there. The first one we set up was in Carrizo Springs. The second one was in Crystal City. Marilu Masignani was helping me quite a bit with those efforts también. And, matter of fact, we have a commitment award that we give every year, the Marilu Masignani Award for Commitment, you know, in the alternative ed area.
Do you remember how to spell her last name?
Yes. Masignani. Yeah. And she helped us a lot.
She passed away.
She passed away, yeah. She passed away 3 years ago, if I'm not mistaken. And so that basically gave me some impetus to then say, we need to get the nonprofit going. And then there was a very, Mario Sotelo, who's now the superintendent in Edinburgh. He was from Del Rio originally, and he became superintendent in Pecos. He became the superintendent of Carrizo Springs. We marketed the idea. He was sold on it. The school board sold on it. We started out with 11 kids there in Carrizo Springs and graduated 6 out of those 11 kids, one more than half. They were out of school altogether. And I'll be darned, you know, by that time, then people started, you know, that's not too bad, you know. By the time we had graduated 6 kids there, had 11 and 20, and then Crystal City came into play in Cotula, and then once it was just, you know, by that time, word of mouth.